Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune. For your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon. With your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely croon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's July the 24th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I got a few emails over the past week hinting that I need to get back into the comfort zone with more of the pablum of the right wing, i.e. news commentary. It's nice and safe, and it doesn't piss people off. It doesn't demand that people actually do anything. It can be listened to as pure entertainment, and it won't bring the secret police knocking on anybody's door, because nobody cares what my opinion on the news is, so long as I'm only speaking to a few thousand people every week. Fine. Dear Harold, what is your opinion on what is going on our southern border with all those Beaner kids marching in and being bussed all over the country? What do you think will happen? I think the dictatorship has de facto abolished the border, since they know now that they can get away with it and nothing will be done. And now the true mudflow begins, which will lead to a majority Hispanic and Mestizo population on this continent within 50 years, including Canada, and which will effectively make us part of Latin America, with a small and shrinking population of elderly white people who will be slowly tortured to death in various ways by hate-filled niggers and spics and hoppas. I think nothing at all is going to be done about it, because the Republican Party, which is the only legal means of dissent and resistance which our lords and masters allow us to have, is too completely spineless and invested in the system to resist at all. Even if the Republicans could find some balls somewhere, democracy as a form of government is useless, and electoral politics are meaningless. I think the few spontaneous demonstrations by white residents in Murrieta, California, and some other towns where the illegals were about to be dumped were mildly interesting, but nothing more. Those people were holding signs and not rifles. And if we have learned anything from the past 50 years, it's that standing in the street holding a sign doesn't work. The system simply ignores it. The system is set up specifically to ignore and work around any number of people standing in the street holding a sign. Remember the 1969 anti-Vietnam War moratorium where 250,000 people marched in the streets of Washington, D.C. demanding that Nixon end the Vietnam War, and he simply ignored it. He wasn't even in town at the time. The most that these demonstrations accomplished was to divert a few buses of brownies away from these people's own communities, usually to some government facility only a few miles away. Now, having quote-unquote succeeded in getting the dictatorship to at least stash the hundreds and thousands of brownies out of sight somewhere, which, by the way, actually most likely fits in with the regime's agenda, since they want to keep all this as low-key as possible. Anyway, now the relatively small white crowds of a few hundred who think they've won something will disperse and go back to sit on their sofas and flick their television remotes. I think at least 500,000 of these brown kiddies are now in the country who were not here 6 months ago, and I think they will never be removed. Not legally, anyway. Dear Harold, what do you think of the shooting down of the Ukraine airliner? Do you think it's a big conspiracy and false flag operation to discredit Vladimir Putin and start a war with Russia? Well, anytime you're dealing with Zionist politics, you're going to have some weird stuff going on. And that's what the Ukraine situation is at the root. It's an attempt by world Zionism to stab a knife into Russia's gut by setting up a Zionist puppet regime in Kiev. And when you've got a situation like that, you always have to consider the possibility that something like this is a false flag operation or some kind of black op or some sort of weird intrigue. Just like anytime anyone died around Stalin, you had to consider the possibility that Stalin had him poisoned or secretly murdered. Now, I don't know, and I suspect no one ever will. It is entirely possible that this isn't some sort of bizarre deep conspiracy, that it's just an especially nasty combination of incompetence and bad luck and being in the wrong place at the wrong time, of the sort which democracy and Western society as a whole specializes in producing with great regularity. In any case, by now the facts have become so heavily obscured that it's probably beyond any actual investigation and determination. Now, I still don't think that anybody in the West, including our man-child president, is actually so stupid as to go to war with Russia. What I think they're trying to do on both sides is to turn the clock back 40 years. Putin is trying to restore the Soviet Union, and the West wants to restore the Cold War, and Israel wants its finger in the pie because the Jews hate the Russians on general principles. Now, the method that the European nations, the West, and the Jews are using to try and undermine Russia is to sneak into the Ukraine, which is basically Russia's soft underbelly, so to speak, grab the government there, bring it into the European Union, and make it a puppet regime of some kind, which, of course, would create a strategic base for future aggression against Russia right on Russia's doorstep. The Russians cannot have this. Anyone with any basic knowledge of geopolitics understands that the Russians cannot allow this. And so we go. I don't think there's going to be any big cataclysmic war of aggression by the West against Russia, but I could be wrong. The situation could just get completely out of control without either side intending for that to happen, and it could escalate into a war against Russia through sheer incompetence and American inability to control events. The Americans have been prone to a lot of that recently.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to review Dreamer of the Day, which is a biography about Francis Parker Yockey. Now, Yockey was an important rightist thinker that was involved from the 1930s all the way up till 1960, when he ends up briefly going to prison. Now, the origins of Yockey are rather unclear in terms of his genealogy, and perhaps because of this, he really embraces the ideas of Oswald Spengler. Spengler was rather amorphous on the idea of race and is more specific on the notion of culture. Spengler believed that every society goes through three phases. It goes through a culture phase, a civilization phase, and then a totalitarian phase. And Spengler believed that we were now in the violent winter time of the West. Now, Yockey is so impressed by the ideas of this Spengler that he actually goes to Germany, and so begins a real love affair with the far right, particularly in Germany. Now, in 1936, Spengler dies. The National Socialists are publicly grieved, but privately glad of his death. And this is because there's an association between the ideas of Spengler and also the ideas of Strasser. So Spengler is kind of a bit on the outs. During the phase, Yockey gets involved with a lot of bunds, things like the Silver Shirts. He also gets involved with the Father Coughlin group. So he's very active. Then, in the 40s, the war comes about, and there's an attempt to draft Yaki, but in September of 1942, Yaki goes AWOL from his unit. And it's uncertain what he was doing at that time, but there's a great deal of suspicion that he was involved in Operation Pastoris. Now, this was a rather odd development during World War II, and this was a plan that some Germans were going to come over to the States in U-boats, and they were going to become saboteurs and spies. It's rumored that somehow Yaki was directly involved in this, and that's why he disappeared. But the operation was not successful because these Germans are stopped by the Coast Guard, and they become very panicked by this, and they end up turning themselves in, or at least most of them do. So when Yaki returns to his unit, he feigns a psychological illness, and he ends up getting discharged from the Army. Now, this is no doubt for the best, because the truth is, from the perspective of the Army, if he'd really been able to go over to Europe, Yaki would have defected in the first 5 minutes. So, in a sense, he really was unable to be in the Army. Yaki ends up finishing up law school, and when the war is over, he requests to go to Europe to go to the Nuremberg trials, and while he's in Nuremberg, gets involved with the black market and the werewolf resistance, and he also writes pamphlets for Natinform, which is a propaganda group that spreads propaganda to Germans in South America. He also goes to England, and he attempts to work with Mosley. At this point, Yaki writes Imperium, and this is a new treatise. It's the first post-war treatise on nationalism, and Yaki is very excited, and he wants Mosley to read the treatise, and Mosley is really not interested. Finally, Mosley takes a look at it, but Mosley is really put off by it because Yaki is very anti-American. Now, the story is that Yaki became anti-American because he blamed America's father's drinking problem, although his anti-Americanism is very profound and probably more having to do with his intellectual beliefs. But Mosley really wants nothing to do with this treatise. Mosley has probably become more moderate due to his time in prison, and he probably sees American hegemony as an acceptable alternative to Soviet hegemony. So he's just not into it, and so of course this causes an alienation between Mosley and Yaki. But you have to understand that another intellectual influence on Yaki was Haushofer and also Mackinder. These are two individuals that very much believe in something called land power, and they believe in Germany uniting with Eastern Europe and Russia to become this land power so there can be an Imperium Europa. Now, another person that really is suspect of Yaki because he sees Yaki as a Strasserite is George Lincoln Rockwell. Same thing with Colin Jordan and Keith Thompson. They all are very much skeptical of Yaki. So pretty much the whole Coxwold group tends to dislike Yaki. The primary contribution of Yaki is the fact that he brings Russia into the far right. And today, of course, Russia is a key contributor to that trend within Europe. As far as the Imperium itself, apparently there were a lot of rightists who did not really understand the Imperium, but one author who tries to smooth things over for Yaki is Willis Carto, And Willis Carto tries to smooth over some of Yaki's soft ideas about race when he talks about the dangers of a culture becoming universalist and absorbing racial poisons. John Gannon really criticizes Willis Carto for what he wrote in the introduction, because John Gannon apparently was a Yakiist who felt that Carto, like many other people, didn't really understand Yaki. Now, one individual who apparently did understand Yaki was Dee Benoist. And he was tempted to move away from biopolitics into a more Yaki-oriented cultural critique to such a degree that Benoist started to be critical of Le Pen's National Front anti-immigration policy. So in that case, perhaps it's just as well that Imperium was not understood by very many. The way this book is organized, the first half will tell you an awful lot about Yaki's life. And the second half of the book really goes into more tangential influences on Yaki. And it also goes a lot into Evola, who was another strong influence on Yaki, because both Evola and Yaki tended to be traditional aristocratic thinkers who were both very excited about this notion of the SS as a new class of kshatriyas within Europe. So, in a sense, this book is about the more leftist tendencies on the right. And also, it tells us that Yakiism is not a separate train of thought in Europe today. Rather, it's a component that you will sometimes find within the far right. Next time I'm on, I'll actually be discussing Imperium itself, and so I can develop an opinion as to whether or not this biography is on target in terms of the way it describes Imperium. Good evening, and hail victory, comrades.
I've been hearing Mr. Covington speak about the white character issue for some time. I was wanting a definition of what he meant, and I found a list of things I think address this issue. White folk virtues. Courage. My fear does not keep me from defending my folk, my family, or myself. I conquer my fear. Discipline. I control my mind, will, and emotions. I do, of my own accord, what needs to be done. Fidelity. I keep the vows I make, especially those to folk, family, and self. Honor. I keep pure the name and honor of my folk, family, and self. Hospitality. For folk and family, I willingly share my food, hearth, and shelter. Industriousness. I perform my tasks with joy and honor, holding nothing back. Perseverance. I continue until I've met my obligations and my goals. Self-reliance. I support my folk, my family, and myself. I depend only on myself. I strengthen the independence of the folk and family. Truth. I search for and embrace the truth. When speaking the truth may harm my folk or family, I keep silent. Live with courage and honor, comrades.
My father, in addition to being many other things, most of them unspeakable, was a pretty good folk singer and guitarist back in the 1960s when folk was all the rage. Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul and Mary, that kind of thing. He had his own folk music TV show on Channel 2 in Greensboro for a season, and he also played the local university coffeehouse circuit in Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh. On several occasions, he actually opened in local coffeehouses for a woman folk singer named Joan Baez, who most likely nobody younger than me will remember at all, but who used to be really the bomb back in the mid-60s if you were an up-and-coming hippy-dippy leftist folk music type. I never met her personally, although I did meet some other people in that scene through Daddy. In the past, I played some of the music from that period on this show. Kingston Trio, Walter Forbes, Pete Seeger, Pentangle, Fairport Convention, and even one or two Joan Baez songs. Now, a lot of the music from that period was really pretty good, and Joan Baez herself wasn't a bad picker and singer, it's just that her politics were so far left as to be outright deranged. She especially got into the whole Black Panther shtick around 1970 or so, along with a lot of other liberal jackasses whose names would mean nothing to people now. Now, someone sent me this without attribution. I'm tempted to say it's a parody, but to be honest, I'm not sure. It may be a takeoff, but I swear it sounds just like something Joan Baez would sing.
And now, her nibs.
Jackson was the name, his blood was like a flame that lit the prison walls from dawn to dusk. Fire with fire, eye for eye, truth for truth in the blazing sky, he dropped the men of darkness as they came. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay. Joan Baez is the name, I've a house by the sea. My songs come rolling in off Highway 1. Just because I can't be there doesn't mean that I don't care. So next time, brother, off a pig for me. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay. Songs, but I know you'll always be there to fall back on. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay. Pull the triggers, niggers, we're with you all the way, just across the bay.
And now it's time once again for Crius Custodiet Ipsos Custodes, or Who Guards the Guardians? That's RFN's new weekly feature that compares the image and portrayal of federal law enforcement in the movies and on TV to what these people are like in real life. Now, by the way, one of our Latin scholars on the list corrected my pronunciation of the tagline there. Apparently it's Quis Custodiet instead of Qui Custode. The phrase actually is a line from one of the satires of the Roman poet Juvenal. Now, before we get into the main part of this week's segment, though, here's a quick little tidbit of FBI's I'd like to share with all you folks. Now, back in January, the Supreme Court ruled on something called the Jones case to the effect that placing a GPS device on a car represented a search, and it was trespassing if whatever secret police agency was involved didn't get a warrant. Now, for whatever arcane internal reasons, the FBI decided to at least pretend to be complying with this ruling, and it came out that they have placed over 3,000 concealed GPS trackers on the automobiles of American citizens without warrants. No indication at all of what these 3,000 people are alleged to have done, or why the FBI wants to follow their cars by satellite. And frankly, if you think it's only 3,000 of these things they've snuck onto people's cars, I think you've got another thing coming. Now, the Bureau says that they turned off all these unauthorized and illegal tracking devices like good little boys when the Supreme Court told them to, and they claim that they are surreptitiously trying to remove the units from the vehicles. But apparently, they're now having trouble retrieving many of them, since our brilliant detectives and manhunters, our steely-eyed Seeley Booths and Aaron Hotchners and Jack Bowers, don't know where they are. They have now asked the Supreme Court for permission to turn the devices back on so that they can find them and remove them. You know, we really shouldn't be anywhere near as afraid of these people as we are. They're really just not that good at what they do. As secret police go, the Gestapo and Stalin's NKVD and the East German Stasi could run rings around them. But now, on to the main part of this segment of Who Guards the Guardians. This week we have a truly gripping saga for you. A tale of passion in the corridors of power, of greed, lust, adultery, perversion, kidnapping, and attempted murder. Special Agents Eugene and Margot Bennett, come on down. In 1992, the well-known millionaire mystery writer, Patricia Cornwell, applied to the FBI Academy at Quantico for technical assistance in writing one of her Kay Scarpetta detective novels. The Scarpetta series was one of the first to make detective heroes out of medical examiners and forensic science geeks. Well, not the first. Quincy was the first, but he's a white male, so he doesn't count. The agent selected to serve as Ms. Cornwell's docent in the FBI, give her the Quantico tour, help her on the technical details with a book, so forth and so on, was a female agent named Margot Bennett, who was married to another FBI agent, Eugene Bennett, a big man of 6'2", who had run several undercover operations for the FBI against actual criminals. Yeah, there was a time when the FBI didn't spend their time sitting in cubicles reading people's email and listening to this podcast, but actually tried to apprehend real criminals. Hard to believe, isn't it? Jean Bennett was actually one of the few agents in recent times who somewhat lived up to the typical Hollywood stereotype of the heroic FBI guy. He was pretty good in undercover work. He ran one sting operation on drug dealers in Atlanta by pretending to be a connected guy and running a whole Italian restaurant called Tony's, to which he brought the dopers in limousines one night, allegedly to meet a mafia boss. When they arrived, they were arrested by a SWAT team. That kind of thing. He met his wife in 1982 when she was a rookie agent in Atlanta. Margot was already known in FBI circles as, quote-unquote, the blonde bitch, allegedly for her tenacity and drive. Yeah, that was why, I'm sure. Now, Jean and Margot got married in 1984 and had two daughters, and for a time they were the FBI's golden couple, the poster children for the new politically correct face of federal law enforcement. Unknown to Eugene, though, his wife Margot was bisexual and had engaged in at least one lengthy lesbian relationship before she met her husband, a fact which she carefully concealed from him before her marriage. Then enter Patricia Cornwell. Now there's a book which has been written about this incident called Twisted Triangle by Caitlin Rother and John Hess. I haven't read this book, and my information here comes from the internet and especially from one really grotty article in the UK Daily Mail, but also from memory because I was around and paying attention when this happened. Now, according to the Daily Mail summary of this new book, Twisted Triangle, Patricia Cornwell used the excuse of getting background information for her next novel to start hanging out with Margot Bennett, including what Jean Bennett's divorce paper subsequently referred to as quote-unquote long romantic candlelit dinners. Despite still being married to Jean, Margot began to accompany Cornwell to literary events, including a party for the release of another Kay Scarpetta bestseller, All That Remains, after which they went to bed. I won't go into the really revolting details of Patricia Cornwell's seduction of Margot Bennett here. I will say that since this whole thing exploded in her face, Patricia Cornwell has been downplaying it and denied that it was anything serious. In an interview appearing in the May 1997 Vanity Fair magazine, the Cornwell woman called the affair, and I quote, "not even two trips over the rug. It was very brief in every way you can imagine," end quote. Okay. Way to kiss and tell there, Patsy. But apparently husband Gene didn't think that his wife's excursion into the world of tribadism was such small potatoes. Inevitably, he found out about it, and then the whole thing degenerated from Criminal Minds down into soap. Okay, that may be a bit too obscure a TV reference for you younger folks out there before your time. Well, let's just say hubby found out and the whole thing went to hell in a handbasket. Margot struck the first blow in this little FBI version of the War of the Roses. She legally separated, moved out of the house, took the kids, and reported Gene to the FBI for fraud. It seems that Gene was not clean himself. He liked to stick his fingers into the bureau cookie jar. Margot knew that her husband was involved in a number of shady deals, including a jewelry business with one of his informants. Also, when the couple moved to Washington, D.C., he became involved in an illegal scam to claim relocation expenses for a house they'd never lived in, for which he fraudulently received $17,873 from the FBI. Eugene Bennett was fired from the bureau, arrested, and charged with fraud. But 4 days before the trial in 1993, he attacked Margot, who was due to give evidence against him, with a stun gun in an attempt to get her to change her testimony. Now, she apparently tried to change it or withdraw it. The material I've been able to find isn't quite clear on that, but Gene was convicted anyway and ended up doing a year in prison. Uncle Slime will let his servants kill and get away with almost anything, but not with stealing Uncle Slime's money. Now, reading between the lines, the Bureau must not have been too happy with the whole situation, though, and for reasons which I again was unable to determine clearly, they fired Margot as well, or else asked her to resign at about the same time. Now, it could be that in 1993 there were still some vestigial remnants of morality in the FBI code of conduct, or standards of professional ethics, or whatever. If so, they're all gone now. All I can say, yet again, is that under J. Edgar Hoover, none of this nonsense would have happened. Now, the first thing Bennett did when he got out of the slammer was to file for divorce and demand full custody of his two children, and he was quite open about the fact that he didn't want his daughters to be raised by a lesbian. He wanted them to grow up sexually normal. Look, as much as I despise the Bureau and everything to do with it, even though I know full well that Gene Bennett would have killed me or fabricated false evidence to convict me of a crime I didn't commit had he been ordered to do so, it's difficult for me not to be at least a little bit sympathetic to this man. Now, it seems that there was a little more to the affair than Patricia Cornwell has ever admitted to. Gene testified that he'd followed his wife and discovered her meeting Cornwell secretly for romantic dinners and had seen them hugging and kissing in their vehicles. He also testified that he had found sexual lingerie, sex toys, and lesbian pornographic material in the house, where his daughters could find it. Beautiful. His wife would visit Cornwell's Richmond home. She accepted expensive gifts and clothes from her and spoke with her on the phone constantly. He said the couple would often meet at a gay bar near Quantico. Bennett said that while laughing at him, Margot Bennett admitted the affair and asked Mr. Bennett why it took him so long to figure out that she was a dyke. Okay, no more of that. You get the idea. Anyway, when Gene got out of prison in 1995, he seems to have gone completely insane. And considering the FBI's famous blonde bitch had taken his career, his home, and his children away from him, again, it's not hard to sympathize, or at least to understand. But instead of using his bureau training to exact some neat, precise, and fiendish Agatha Christie-style revenge, poor old Gene Bennett just plain freaked out, and he pulled what has got to be one of the stupidest capers in criminal history. He concocted this truly bizarre plan in which he was going to lure his ex-wife into a church, blow it up with her and the minister inside with a bomb detonated by a vibrator, and then blame it on her and collect a $250,000 insurance policy he'd fraudulently obtained along with a female accomplice, who apparently had no idea who she was dealing with or what she was getting herself into. On June the 23rd, 1996, Bennett abducted the minister, Alva Cleaver, and forced him to make a phone call, luring his ex-wife to the Prince of Peace United Methodist Church in Manassas, Virginia. Bennett met his wife in the church, all attired in black, with a black ski mask on, and the Reverend Cleaver was bound to a chair with what appeared to be a suicide bomb vest strapped to his body. Margot recognized her husband despite the black getup, and while he was delivering some kind of strange Dr. Evil supervillain kind of speech, she hits him with pepper spray. Then she runs into an office and hides behind a desk, and when he comes blundering in after her, she takes a shot at him, but she misses. Now, once the pepper spray has worn off, Bennett stands outside the door and goes on with his supervillain speech and tells her all about how he's going to blow them all up or whatever. Anyway, in the meantime, she's pulled out one of the earliest cell phones and she's called the cops. Bennett hears the sirens and he runs off. Contrary to politically correct urban legends about this bird-brained incident, Margot did not valiantly subdue her 6'2" husband with pepper spray and detain him, using the politically correct feminist line inspired by Hillary Clinton or whatever. She hid behind a desk and waited for the white male police to come and rescue her. Bennett was actually arrested at his home. Now, it's difficult to fathom just what Bennett intended. Among the items found around the church were a stethoscope, several syringes, saline solution, blindfolds, and a tube of glue. Five further hoards of material would be found at other locations, including razor blades, lesbian pornography, a book entitled A History of Witchcraft, a gas mask, latex gloves, and explosives. Now, the explosive vest on the minister turned out to be a fake. But the police discovered a genuine pipe bomb outside the church and another in a locker at Northern Virginia Community College where Margot was a campus cop. Not sure how he got that one in there. And one more thing. The pipe bomb was a strange foot-long contraption wrapped with shiny black electrical tape. It was all the more peculiar because it had a black vibrator attached to it. When detonated by bomb disposal experts, it was found to contain a deadly mix of fish hooks and nails. A map of Patricia Cornwell's neighborhood was also discovered. Now, at his trial, Bennett pleaded insanity. He claimed that the emotional abuse his wife inflicted on him had created an alter ego in his mind he called Ed, and that it was this alternate identity who committed all the crimes. It didn't work, and he's still in prison. Folks, next time these Nimrods show up on your doorstep just wanting to come in and have a nice friendly chat, remember not just who they're working for, but what kind of people they are. They're not just hired killers and perjurers for Obama. They are men and women who are utterly unworthy of any personal respect by the very fact that they do what they do and associate with the kind of people that they associate with. They claim some kind of moral superiority that gives them the right to destroy the lives of others. They have no such right. They do it because they can, and because we are too timid and frightened to stop them.
Secret agent man, secret agent man, they've given you a number, all they've taken away.
Okay, I just learned that that song I played first, the Joan Baez thing, or allegedly the Joan Baez thing, was in fact a parody put out by National Lampoon back in the 1970s when you could get away with that sort of thing. Okay, that's all very amusing, but in a way I feel kind of bad because the fact is Joan Baez was actually a pretty good singer and musician, and she did some really beautiful stuff. like so many of these so-called folk singers of the 60s and the 70s, it was just a matter of getting them away from that leftist drivel. And when you could do that, they could actually make some pretty fine music. So this is the real Joan Baez doing an old Southern gospel number of a non-leftist drivel nature. This is an old number called Will the Circle Be Unbroken? Right, this next clip is from Brian H., and I have no idea who he is or where he's from, but he calls this Reflections While Stuck in Traffic, and he apparently recorded this on his phone while stuck in traffic, which is something most of you guys can do. I can convert certain formats to MP3 here, including this one, which was something called MP4A. Anyway, here's Brian.
What has happened in the United States is we have competing spheres of power, and the old president that warned us against the rise of the military-industrial complex was not heeded. So we're going to have a situation where the CIA slash whoever it is that organizes the NGOs and plots the coups in foreign countries is going to get us in over our heads. So we have this kind of a crusading for egalitarian liberal democracy that is going throughout the world. You can see it right now against Russia. All these problems with Russia started because they tried to cramp down on homosexual activists. Ever since then, we've been antagonizing them because our worldview is anything goes. So what caused these competing circles of hidden power to rise in this country? Well, you can't even really say that they're competing. They just have different spheres of influence. You've got the military-industrial complex controlling our foreign policy, and then you've got the what people call the Illuminati controlling the entertainment industry. They're the ones twisting and corrupting America's youth. They're the ones assassinating stars that have outshined themselves. They're the ones just inserting all the anti-white, anti-God propaganda into our mainstream culture. That's the two that I really identified. And then there's, of course, the banking elite. That's another sphere of power. So you got these three spheres of power that are unchecked in American society. Well, why are they unchecked? What happened in American society that caused the average American to withdraw from civic involvement? What caused people to disassociate themselves from their communities? What destroyed the feeling of community in this country? Well, it was the introduction of the other, the one who is not like me, the one who is not of my community, therefore I have less of a feeling of community. In other words, integration with the blacks. By forcing us to assimilate and integrate with the blacks, people have lost their feelings of community, often because they have to move constantly to stay ahead of black crime, ghettoization of their neighborhoods. So America has gotten this throwaway culture because there's no permanent roots anymore. You don't know who your neighbor is. You can't trust your neighbor. You got to move and keep moving to stay ahead of the Afro-cancer.
Dear HAC, what is your opinion on Oswald Mosley and the British Union of Fascists and the fascist ideology in general? Perhaps you could talk about this on your radio show. It's a very interesting subject. Okay, it's been a while since I played any movement historical stuff on here. Now, I do have some brief recordings of Oswald Mosley speaking, but unfortunately, all of them seem to be from his post-war period when his teeth were pretty much pulled after the British Union of Fascists became the British Union. I do know that he left an enduring memory behind in our movement in Britain, and that for many years the mainstay of groups like the National Front and the BNP were the old Mosley men until basically they all died out.
British Union is the movement of the people of Britain. It is their answer and their challenge to the tyranny that today oppresses them. That tyranny is the money power of international finance, which commands government, parliament, and the old political parties. In the service of finance, an obsolete and decadent system is preserved, both in government and industry. Government is paralyzed by a system of universal talk in which nothing can be done, in order that real power may rest elsewhere, not in the hands of those chosen by the people, but in the hands of those chosen by finance. Industry is tied to the international system of 100 years ago, again in the interests of finance alone. In both home and foreign markets, British workers have to compete against the cheap coolie labor of the East, paid a third of our wages and working for 10 hours a day. Yet this cheap slave labor has been supplied by finance with the best modern machinery, in order that a higher rate of usury may be drawn from sweating the East than from equipping the West. In face of these new conditions, how can any international system, whether it be capitalist or socialist, maintain the British standard of life, let alone increase it to the high level that modern science makes possible and that our great people deserve? For in this modern age, science gives to us British the power to use our own great heritage of British Empire to build the greatest civilization the world has ever seen. We have the finest workers and technicians. Within the empire alone, we possess unlimited raw materials to satisfy every demand of industry. One thing alone we lack, a market to absorb the great wealth that modern industry can produce. That market is the purchasing power of the British people. They are robbed of the power to buy British goods because their wages are dragged down by cheap slave competition from abroad. They are subject to that competition because finance draws its usury from foreign investment in the shape of cheap foreign goods. We British are denied our heritage by the power of usury. So we challenge finance and the parties who have sold the people to usury to carry out the people's will and to subordinate to the nation the vested interests who today exploit the people. We ask from the people power for the people's government. That power will be freely given by the vote of the people and can be removed by the vote of the people. But the government elected by the people must have power to act. If the people's government has not power to govern, then the money power will continue to govern. That money power has divided the British people in order that it may rule them. We have been divided by the war of party, of class, and of faction. So the British, who for 1,000 years have never been conquered by the foe without, have been subdued by the foe within. Britons, who should be brothers, have fought each other, and alien finance has conquered. Therefore, to our brother Britons, we say, unite! Britain united is invincible and irresistible, and together we will build the mightiest civilization mankind has known. A new world awaits the united will of Britain reborn. Britain's advance in British Union.
Africa, like the other poor devils in China, India, and Japan, a great new field for sweatshops to be opened up so that these new industries which we're creating in Britain today will be destroyed as the old industries were. Simplified, rationalized machinery with a few white surveyors, and then the masses of cheap colored labor torn off the land and taken into the sweatshops to work and labor and cough their guts out with tuberculosis until they too thrown on the scrap heap of the sweatshops. Is that worthy of Britain? Is that to be the future of Europe? And is this competition to be organized within our European brotherhood, bringing in these sweat fields in Africa into our Europe civilization so that the financial power in one European country can use it against the financial power in another? Or the great financial central power of the world, now shifted from the city of London to Wall Street, New York, shall be able, on the mass of money, of wealth, and of power which it brings to it, again and again to exert its influence in politics, until, as you see today, it is childish nonsense to say that a British government rules Britain. It's nothing to do with British government or the British people. The government of the world is the financial government, the power of money, and of money alone.
Actually, it turns out I was wrong. I do have one old recording of Sir Oswald Mosley from the black shirt days. And again, I'm not quite certain what the context is here, but this is evidently pre-war when he was an open fascist.
Brother black shirts, my comrades in the struggle. Our fight is for the soul of Britain. And in that battle, we go forward together till victory be won. Our struggle is hard, because we are fighting for something great, and great things are not lightly or easily gained. We are fighting for nothing less than a revolution in the spirit of our people. We must be worthy of our mission, for black shirts are those who are summoned to lead the people to a new and a higher civilization. The black shirt is a revolutionary dedicated to the service of our country, who must always possess the character of the true revolutionary. It is not the character that you observe in the little men of the old parties, blown hither and thither by every gust of transient opinion, elated by a little success, downcast by a little failure, gossiping and chattering about the prospects of the next 5 minutes, jostling for place, but not so forward in service, without loyalty, endurance, or staying power. Such a character is the hallmark of financial democratic politics. It is the opposite of the National Socialist. In the true revolutionary, the first quality is the power to endure. Constancy, loyalty to cause and comrades, manhood and stability of nature. These are the qualities of the true Briton and the true revolutionary. In our movement, that great character of the British has been reborn. And for that reason, we carry within us the destiny of Britain. We care not whether we win tomorrow morning or at the end of a lifetime of labor and of struggle. For to us, the little calculations of the little men mean nothing. All we care is that win we will, because Britain demands it and no power on earth can hold down the will within us. Struggles we have had and will have. Blows we have taken and will again. Victories we have had and will have again. Yes, greater victories than even Britons have ever known. Through good and ill we march on, till victory be won, for this is the character of the true revolutionary. In the great moments of supreme struggle and decision, it is easy to hold that character, even in supreme sacrifice. It is not so easy in the hard daily task. It is then, even more than in the great fights we have together, that I would like to be the companion of every one of you. I would like to be with every action team that carries the message of our new faith to new streets. I would like to be with every man or woman doing the hard but vital job of giving leadership to the people in the block of houses for which they are responsible. For these are the jobs that count. By the dedication of thousands to that mission of leading the people in their own homes and streets, revolution is won. In that task, I cannot in body be with every one of you every day. But in spirit, I am with you always. Because this work of the dedicated black shirt will win the Britain for which my whole spirit is given. Together in Britain, we have lit a flame that the ages shall not extinguish. Guard that sacred flame, my brother black shirts, until it illumines Britain and lights again the spark of mankind.
Tell you what, since I was talking a while ago about good old left-wing drivel folk singers from the 60s who, despite it all, weren't bad musicians, here's Pete Seeger.
Men walking along the railroad tracks, going someplace there's no going back. Highway patrol choppers coming up over the ridge. Hot soup on a campfire under the bridge. Shelter lines stretching round the corner. Welcome to the New World Order. Families sleeping in their cars in the Southwest. No home, no job, no peace, no rest. The highway is alive tonight, but nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes. I'm sitting down here in the campfire light, searching for the ghost of Tom Joad.
He pulls a prayer book out of a sleeping bag. Preacher lights up a butt antiques of drag. Waiting for when the last shall be first and the first shall be last. In a cardboard box near the underpass, we got a one-way ticket to the promised land. You got a hole in your belly and a gun in your hand. Sleeping on a pillow of solid rock. Bathing in the city at dawn.
The highway is alive tonight.
The highway is alive tonight.
But nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes.
Where it's headed.
I'm sitting down here in the campfire light.
I'm sitting down here in the campfire light.
Searching for the ghost of Tom Joad.
Waiting on the ghost of Tom Joad.
Now Tom said, Mom, wherever there's a cop beating a guy, wherever a hungry newborn baby cries, where there's a fight against the blood and hatred in the air, look for me, Mom, I'll be there. Wherever there's somebody fighting for a place to stand, for a decent job or a helping hand, wherever somebody's struggling to be free, look in their eyes, Mom. You'll see me.
Wherever somebody's struggling to be free, look in their eyes, Mom. You'll see me.
The highway is alive tonight.
The highway is alive tonight.
But nobody's kidding nobody about where it goes.
It's city, everybody knows.
I'm sitting down here in the campfire
sitting
light.
Sitting down here in the campfire light.
Searching for the ghost of Tom Joad.
Waiting on the ghost of Tom Joad.
Okay, I want to close out this episode with some housekeeping notes. Now, right now, we have a large, heavy box of books floating around in the postal system. It was sent to me to the wrong address for parcels, unsolicited by someone I do not know, who apparently is unable or unwilling to email me directly or reveal his identity beyond an internet pseudonym, and who keeps trying to communicate through one of the bulletin boards, most likely because he doesn't want to reveal his name and email address to me out of rampaging paranoia or whatever. Now, I do not know the exact contents of this box, but my guess is it's a bunch of books, probably quite good books, that tell me in many different ways things that I already know and have known for years. I get this a lot. Elderly movement guys feel the cold claws of their own mortality tickling their toes, and understandably enough, they want something to do with their personal libraries, in some cases literally a lifetime of accumulated racial knowledge. What to do, what to do? They can't leave the books to their idiot liberal children or grandchildren, because they'll just throw them away or give them to the local book exchange for 10 cents a volume just to get them out of the house. Yes, that happens a lot. Oh, I know! Instead of those books sitting on my shelf, gathering dust, waiting for me to cack, I'll pack them up in boxes and ship them all off to Harold so they can gather dust on his shelves until he cacks. Great! Problem solved! Now, this has happened time and again down through the years, and since I believe that a racial book is utterly useless just sitting on the shelves, I generally just give these tomes away, so the collections get broken up anyway. I'm not knocking these gifts, because in many cases they really do include priceless out-of-print volumes. Now, that's how I got my own copies of The Jew Comes to America, The Tragic Era, The Red Decade, and so forth. But, frankly, it is pretty annoying when people simply send me big, huge, heavy boxes of stuff without any prior consultation at all, and the boxes end up sitting in the wrong place for someone to come with a vehicle to pick them up, or in this case, they'll probably simply sit there until the post office sends it back, because for reasons I won't get into, getting a vehicle into that particular place is a major project for us, and it may not be feasible for quite a while. Look, if you have something you want to send me, please check with me first and I will tell you, A, if I want it, and B, where to send it and how. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.